And you're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM. We're very pleased to be bringing you the sources you don't ordinarily get to hear in the corporate for-profit media. We bring you news and views from a labor perspective, from a radical perspective on all sorts of things all over the world. I know a lot of new listeners are tuning in today, having seen Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War out at Supercrawl, where there is a bunch of exciting events, which you will be updated about rather shortly. We have so much to update our listeners on with events that have been happening in the city of Hamilton, as well as things that are going to be happening. It's been a very exciting month with many very exciting developments. And that's why we have a particularly interesting guest on our program today, one who's been featured in terms of his speeches and lectures. We have recorded them and presented them to our audience through CFMU here on 93.3 CFMU FM. And of course, I'm speaking of Professor Atif Kaborsi. And Professor Kaborsi is celebrated Professor Emeritus of Economics at McMaster. He is with Econometrics. He does consulting. Economic development studies. He's been involved with the United Nations in a number of initiatives over decades, investigating the economy of Palestine, giving advice on economic development to a number of countries in the Middle East and Central Asian region, and a number of other prestigious appointments. And we're very pleased to have him. He may be joining us immediately on the program. Let's see if we've got him on the line. Hi, Atif. Can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, great.
Hi, Brandon.
I can hear you coming in loud and clear now. Thanks. You know, for our listeners, we're actually reaching Professor Kaborsi on his cell phone where he's at a hospital. We had originally intended to get him at his office, but in fact, I think you just witnessed or been present with the delivery of a baby. Is that true?
Right. My grandson, number 5.
Wow. Your grandson. So this is the first a lot of the public has heard about it right here on this program.
Absolutely. And I should get a recording.
I will get you a recording on the internet. This is delightful news. And it's precisely what we're here to talk about today. It's bringing life, the bringing of life.
Life and peace. Yes.
Exactly. And you've been working so hard on that in the last 30 days, 60 days. In fact, you've been part of initiatives with relation to Syria over the entire summer. And before that, we've been working together on a number of initiatives and causes. You've been investigating the situation. You've been speaking it. You spoke well in Toronto. You spoke in Hamilton. People have seen the high definition footage, which is now on Facebook, and it's going to be on YouTube soon enough. The truth is, it's brought a lot of new people into the movement, seeing what you have to say. People like you and your integrity and caliber standing up for peace, standing up for the United Nations. And it reminds me of what I had heard before the war in Iraq, or just before it started, 2003. People were talking about a superpower of peace. They thought there was, in addition to the United States, another alternate superpower, the world movement, Canada, the United States, Great Britain, France, and most of the world, most of the countries that are represented in the United Nations had publics out protesting the war. We thought we were going to stop it in Iraq. We did not succeed, at least in a number of countries. But here so far, it looks like there's been a delay in the war drive to Syria. What do you think about that? Have we bought ourselves some time, or what's the meaning of this?
Well, you called it right, Brandon. It's a delay. But hopefully it will be an end to this belligerency and the use of war to settle disputes and to interfere in a very ugly and disastrous civil war. You can't put a fire by throwing fuel at it. You put a fire by literally take all the causes, all the contributing factors that keep this fire burning. And here we have a chance. We have a breathing space, and hopefully we will use it to do more than breathing, is to get to the deep roots of what this issue that brought this civil war to this flagrant explosion, and see to what extent we can put that fire off. And there is a political solution here, and there is no military solution. It's impossible to solve problems so complex, so intricate as the Syrian crisis by military action. It would be disastrous. It would be nothing but adding fuel to a fire that is burning everything around it.
How do you deal with these kind of crises? How do you deal with these kind of problems? We have a body, an international body, that we've all agreed upon, at least on paper, and that is the United Nations. And I think what's been happening in the UN General Assembly and even in the Security Council, just as in the case of Iraq, you're seeing a very alternate strategy being proposed compared to the drive straight towards war. I guess in one sense, we're protesting an escalation here. We have to make it clear what it is that we're talking about. There is a war in Syria. There's multiple bodies involved external to the country. There's things coming into the country. And There's ways of resolving this. Now, the United Nations, what means or mechanisms does it have available to conduct negotiations or other ways in which people can be brought to a bargaining table without further conflict?
Well, whatever one thinks about the United Nations, it's the only institution we have that can bring together the parties. The United Nations has the convening power that could bring all the different parties to the conflict and to deal with it within the umbrella of the United Nations, which is the umbrella of international law. Any belligerency or any activity outside the United Nations, no matter how rational or rationalized its motives, it's outside the international law. The United Nations is the international law and the body that can sanction activities or solutions or actions within the umbrella of international law. And the United Nations is not necessarily Chapter 7. Everybody wants sanctions, want military actions. The United Nations is also a form, a mechanism that could bring parties to the table, could invite the various parties to the conflict and can exercise the moral power and the political power of asking these members of the state to abide by the Charter of the United Nations. United Nations is not only about Chapter 7, it's about reconciliation, it's about mediation, it's about bringing the parties together, and these have not been used. What we need here is the superpowers to get together. They know all too well that this conflict in Syria has been agitated, has been contributed to by all members of the Security Council and members of the United Nations that are not members of the Security Council. Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. So many countries have really been part of the conflict, part of the problem. This is the time we have to really call on all these parties to cease and desist from sending weapons and mercenaries and financing this ugly war. We need the superpowers, instead of confronting each other on the basis of testing each other's will and trying to gain influence, it's the time to say, look, 100,000 people have been killed. Several millions have been displaced. 48% of the infrastructure of the country is destroyed. 50% is the rate of unemployment. 10 million new Syrians have entered the poverty line. This is about time we really say enough is enough. Let's see what would work as a way. And nobody can do this better than the United Nations. The experiences it has from every place it has been involved has had lots of failures, but had lots of successes. It has ended several wars in Africa, several wars in Asia. And this is about time that we really get the reconciliation forum, get the Geneva II working together, bring these parties. These parties cannot continue to fight if they were not aided, if they were not supported, if they were not financed, if they were not encouraged by the negligence of the international community to come to terms with putting an end to this ugly war.
Yeah, and it's not just about ending wars, it's also about preventing wars from getting worse. And as you point out, the situation can escalate in a very dire fashion with regard to Syria because of the superpower or great power confrontation. Now, in the United Nations, we've seen already in the case of Syria in the last 2.5 years, there are parties willing to come to the table. There's parts of the opposition that are willing to negotiate. The government has been indicating its willingness to negotiate on several issues. Russia and other countries in the Security Council and the General Assembly have been pushing for all sorts of talks and agreements. So it's a matter of willingness or will at this point, I think, if people are actually willing to listen to their publics as politicians. I mean, we've seen an unfortunate case of countries like France where there's been some very hostile rhetoric by the government. I know this. The latest initiative with regard to chemical weapons, there's talk of disarmament and handover of weapons and so forth. It's unfortunate that some countries in NATO don't seem to be enthusiastic about this or not enthusiastic about the speed of this, but, I mean, doesn't this offer one way out?
Well, I absolutely, Brandon. I mean, what is so clear here is that these parties to the conflict in the Middle East are not independent parties. They don't work on their own. They're sponsored, they're, as I said, financed, encouraged, and they're protected and directed. And this is the time where we really have a new narrative, a new paradigm in which we bring these parties, and if the U.S. and Russia come to terms, and look, we have a fantastic success when they came to terms on putting an end and avoiding a belligerency, they succeeded. We have a record of success right there. Bring this to the United Nations. Bring it, and then they are. I mean, this is what's so interesting, is that now saying, okay, we have an agreement, but we really have to bring it and let it be a Security Council resolution. Well, now, if you're using the United Nations in this way, and this has proven so far to be successful, why don't we go the extra step? Why put just only a small fire when you have a chance to put the big fire? Let's right now make sure the Geneva II Convention is brought to bear. Bring these parties. Stop the financing of these parties. Make every party from Saudi Arabia to Turkey to Jordan to Lebanon to Iran to anyone that is contributing to this to be in violation of the United Nations Charter and the working of the United Nations towards a peaceful resolution. And let it stick. And I am convinced that if these superpowers and these parties that have been so far part of the problem, they could be part of the solution. And they could do it very quickly and effectively, and it could come about in a very systematic way.
Yes, you know, in terms of big opportunity, I think you're right. I mean, this is also a chance to call for disarmament of chemical or biological or nuclear weapons throughout the entire Middle East. There's a lot of focus.
Absolutely. I mean, this could not really be thought of. You can solve the Syrian crisis, but it would not solve the problem in the Middle East. What we really need here is an overarching, a more comprehensive attempt to come to terms with the overall conflict and see to what extent you could bring a resolution to the Palestinian question, which is at the heart of all the issues in the Middle East. And I am convinced that if we can get the chemical weapons out of Syria, a necessary corollary to it and something that would make this agreement stick is to start thinking of ridding all the weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East, other chemical weapons that many parties, including Israel, cluster bombs, napalm, white phosphorus, and, you know, uranium, and ultimately, and in a very substantive way, get the nuclear-free zone, because as long as Israel has the nuclear weapon, as we know and we see about us, everybody else is now moving to get a protection for themselves by getting the bomb themselves. We want the bombs out everywhere. What is needed here is to get the Middle East working towards peace and to be free and totally clean of all these destructive mass destruction weapons.
Yeah, you know, you either have disarmament or you have proliferation. Because if you don't have everyone disarm in the Middle East, and there have been initiatives floated to do so, then you have people looking at their neighbor getting invaded and saying, "Oh, I'd better get this weapon. I'd better get that weapon." We saw
absolutely.
We saw what happened to Iraq. We saw what happened to Libya. They got rid of their weapons, and they got bombed and invaded nonetheless. And then, you know, the United States—it's problematic because the United States, Israel, often exempt themselves from some of these conventions about weapons, nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons. So it would be nice if we didn't have double standards and misaligned agreements.
Right. Right. Well, by example, I mean, today the Globe and Mail is reporting that Russia has 44,000 tons of chemical weapons. United States, 31,500 tons. Syria has only 1,000. And these countries that are asking Syria to put all these weapons under the supervision and ultimately destroying them through the United Nations, they have to lead by example. The United States and Russia, both of them, have really been postponing and buying more time. And even the U.S., just only a few weeks, months ago, took an exemption to 2022. This is a time in which you can lead by example, and you lead by allowing this United Nations to work effectively, and cannot work effectively if member states, particularly the Security Council members, to not lead by example.
Yeah, it's a funny thing almost. I heard about this as well and was reading about it, that they say Syria has the third largest stockpile of chemical weapons, 1,000 tons. And then the question was brought up, who had the first two stockpiles? Okay, Russia and the United States have the overwhelming domination there. But people can talk about these things. As you've demonstrated, through the United Nations, it's possible to start seriously discussing whether it's possible to remove these weapons throughout the Middle East. Another issue, though, is the intransigence, so-called intransigence within the United Nations Security Council. It's being portrayed here that the other side is blocking a lot of efforts. I don't know. What's your take on this? I know that Stephen Harper recently came out, and I think he said that the Russians should not have a veto in the Security Council. So what do you think about that?
Well, I wish nobody had a veto. I honestly believe that if you want to make this United Nations a more democratic institution, you really have to bring in some sort of majority rule things. But now, given the fact that we have these vetoes, it's unfortunate that Mr. Harper always is a one-eye judge. He doesn't see both eyes. The United Nations use of the veto in the United Nations Security Council has been far more used by the United States to shield Israel from and to allow Israel's intransigence to continue with impunity from any United Nations call for sanctions or to exact some sort of punity on the Israeli abuse of all the charters and all the human rights in the region.
Well, you know, this exceptionalism being practiced by the United States and those under its umbrella is certainly worrying to me, because although this is very good news with the chemical weapons story, the discussion of removal through the United Nations, handovers, disarmament, in those categories, I know what happened in the case of Iraq. We talk about the WMD generally with Iraq. They got rid of their nuclear weapons program. They got rid of whatever bioweapons programs they had. They did hand over the chemical weapons. But throughout that entire process, the Americans were using the United Nations, and they were complaining Iraq's not disarming fast enough. It's not handing this over fast enough. Or when it got close to 2003 and the build-up to war, February, March, they were saying, well, you know, we're not totally sure they got rid of the weapons yet. We can't wait for the inspectors. You know, are they going to put Syria through the same thing that they did with Iraq?
No, there is a silver lining to all this. I don't want to be cynical, but for God's sake, what really has happened during this crisis is the fact that the American public, the French public, the British Parliament and public have all learned the lessons of the fraudulent claims that were perpetrated and abused democracy to wage the war in Iraq. People have really got the awareness now. They're no longer willing to be misled. And I think that that event and the experience of Iraq has played a major role in constraining the United States and its allies from the resort to violence and to work outside the framework of the UN. The American public, the French public, the British public, the public all over the world, 90% of the population of the world has awakened to the fact that we have to take control of things. We cannot allow our governments to behave in our name in this totally misleading and fraudulent way.
We've certainly seen unprecedented opposition, or at least a much more public and visible opposition this time around. People were mobilizing before there was even agreement within the governments of the various countries to go to war. So in the case of the United Kingdom, there was the demonstrations before Whitehall was deciding on the war. There's demonstrations in Canada while Parliament is prorogued. There's demonstrations while Obama was taking it to his government, while he was taking
it. And salute to the British Parliament for taking that courageous step of preventing Cameron and his government from pursuing a belligerent and violent course.
Yeah, I'm not sure many people were expecting the British Parliament to act like a parliament.
It came as a great example, and this is the kind of examples you want for people who are seeking to bring democracy to their own lands, that it works. In other countries,
isn't that a novel conception? If you want to have democracy, why not have it in your own country first?
And let's see that it works in your country.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly some medicine that the Western countries could take. You know, I know later in the program, we're going to be learning a bit more about some of the Canadian story and the Canadian side to this. Unfortunately, it came out in the newspaper about a week ago that the government, the federal government, had given about $5.1, $5.3 million to the opposition. And according to some people who spoke with MPs, it may have been as high as $100 million to the opposition in Syria. Now, I'm wondering, you know, if hopefully we can end this issue right now with mutual agreements based on disarmament or conventions. That would be the best way. If that doesn't happen, and if we go ahead with this agenda and we continue to send funding in and we send militants and we send weapons and aid, what do you think could be the consequences of this?
Well, you see, I'm quite happy that we are really spending money on dealing with the suffering of people, things. But you know, this would be a bottomless pit, because if you don't go to the root causes and solve this problem, all what you're really giving is basically a drop in the bucket and does not really deal with the suffering of the people. What the people need is a reconciliation. They need a political solution. They want to go home. They want to rebuild. They want to live their lives. And if you continue to support these rebellious movements that have literally devastated the country and have not come to the table as they should have, and to allow the situation to fester, and do not really work and push and encourage these parties to come to the table on both sides, not just only the rebellion but the government, and say, look, a political solution is all what we really need, and that's the only thing that's going to work, and every other course of action is adding to the problem, not to the solution.
Yeah, I think very much this is the case right now. And it's almost time to go, but while I've got you here, and I know it's been an exciting day, I just got to think about Lebanon, because I know the conflict has spilled over a bit through the borders, and Hezbollah has become involved, and so on. You know, how has this affected Lebanon? What's the potential for Lebanon if this goes ahead the way in a dangerous fashion?
Look, we know one thing about the Middle East. It's a powder keg, and there is no problem that can work or can manifest itself in isolation of impacts, consequences on everybody else. Everybody is in. I mean, one thing we really know, and one of the first casualties of this war was the Sykes-Picot Agreement and its borders, because somehow it separated these countries from one another. But we have seen it, and seen it right from day one, that you cannot separate Syria from Jordan, from Lebanon, from Palestine, from Iraq. And here, Turkey is a major player, and there is a very serious consequence that could even escalate to include far away countries, from Iran to Turkey, and even more to Russia and the world. But we really have, and this seems to be somehow glossed over, is that we have hundreds of military assets in the Mediterranean, crowded with the Chinese, Russian, French, Turkish, Israeli warships and things. Anything can happen. I mean, there is no question about it. The situation is very precarious, very unstable, and it's in the best interest of everybody is to put an end to it and make sure that it does not escalate beyond the disastrous consequences that we have been experiencing in Syria and in the immediate neighborhood.
Yes, I agree. And that's why so much of the world, I would say, has agreed with your call for diplomacy and a return to the United Nations. In essence, you're talking about embracing the world, the major combatants involved. It's time to look at world opinion and their desire to end this and put the money into aid for refugees. Well, I know you're going to be working on sending out all sorts of letters and continuing with your work on a diplomatic solution. I know you've been so busy on this, but for today, I have to congratulate you on the birth of a grandchild. That's amazing news. Wow. And our listeners are very happy about it. They should thank Dr. Kaborsi, and they should celebrate with him when they see him. It's been a very exciting day for you, a very exciting month. Only hope for the best. Wow. We'll keep abreast of these developments, and of course, you may be present at more rallies, vigils, and efforts to put this on the right track. So thanks so much for being on our program today, Dr. Kaborsi.
Simon, thank you. I mean, you've been a gem. I mean, your support and your work is commendable, and I'm sure it will bear what we both want, is to bring peace and tranquility to a region that has suffered so much and for so long.
Well, thanks so much. We've all got to do our part. You've done more than enough for today, so I'll let you go. And thanks once again for all our listeners.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Professor Atif Gaborsi, Professor Emeritus Economics at McMaster University, works for Econometrics, a consulting firm managing that, has a lot of independent work for clients, and it goes back to his work on development with the United Nations, looking at the Middle East, Central Asia region, as well as other regions and the economic issues faced by Palestine as a result of the occupation. We'll look at that briefly today as well.